All right, well, Jev, we're going to kick this off with Moles, and then we'll glide on over. We are ready to go. Molly, take it away.
Straight in with a bit of this or that.
Okay,
thinking or doing?
Thinking.
Innovation or evolution?
Innovation.
Collaboration or solo?
Collaboration, every day.
Data-driven or intuition-led?
Intuition-led.
Photos or videos?
Ooh. Depends who's taking the photos. photos?
Hmm. Ollie or Molly?
Molly. That's like a rhetorical question. That's like joke hour.
Well, that's the end of the questions on the podcast. We're done. Wow, Gemma, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is, I think, one that Molly and I have been looking forward to a lot. Well, mainly more because Alex was joining us, but obviously.
This is Gemma getting cancelled, isn't
it? Yeah, unfortunately so. You will be cancelled at the end of this podcast. I guess I want to start off by saying thank you, actually, because you were, I believe, Unknown's third ever client back in the day, 3.5 or however many years ago now. And I think the first ever search we did for you was an creative director in Australia, which was a nice and easy way to start our relationship together. But no, thank you for that. I think the thing I've always known about Amplify, and we'll get into who they are and who you are and that kind of stuff, but Amplify have always been a bit of a pin-up client for us because you've always been in transition, I think, and moving away from being excellent at what you already do. So before we get into that, because I think that's a really interesting journey to hear about, I wanted to ask you our stock question, Kevin. Okay. Who was the first person that made you feel talented?
Che-Che. So Che-Che is my mum. And I think it's... you don't really realise, I've just not too long ago become a parent, you don't really realise, I think, and probably till this juncture in life, quite what your parents are able to instil in you. And unspoken, not obvious, but I think actually always shining a light on that, I think I would put hands down to Che-Che, my hero. But in terms of like from probably the first one I can remember beyond like the family environment is Mrs. Kirigetti, excellent name. She was my English teacher when I was 11. I had probably other talents that were shining at that point. And she was the first one that made me feel like I could write. And I always remember that. So yeah, Mrs. Kirigetti, mainly for her name.
In my head, I thought that was going to be someone that owned Getty Images. And
I know, right? I mean, she might have done.
I took this photo.
She might have done. She's just like teaching as a like nice thing on the side.
Like undercover boss.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So take me in. So now you're a CCO. I want to ask, in your definition, what is a CCO? What is that person doing day to day? A chief creative officer.
The way I talk about it with the team and more broadly, causing great work to happen. That's the job, basically. And I think part of the skill in it now is how you can go to 20,000 feet and then fly straight into 20 and then back out to 20,000 again. You've got to be able to think kind of vision and direction of where the agency's going, where clients are going, where we want the work to go, crucially. But then you've got to be able to get back to a granular level with the team and understand, you know, what's pushing and pulling the work and what they're thinking and feeling and how you connect with that. And, you know, the work isn't about me. The work's about all these amazing creatives that are making it. So how do I clear the way? How do I raise them up? And how do we set an environment that's going to allow great work to happen? And if I can cause that in some way, shape or form, then hopefully I'm doing my job.
What do you dislike about your day to day?
I sound like such a cliche. I'm really lucky. I don't actually dislike a lot about my day to day. No 2 days are the same. I love that. I get to surround myself with amazingly talented people from different walks of life. I love that. So I take a lot of inspiration and I get energized by it, to be totally honest. I think, you know, I'm someone who moves at 1,000,000 miles an hour and that's my fuel, is everyone around me. I think it's the same stuff as everyone else in terms of, you know, some of the fatigues of the industry, in terms of what's going on with timings and actually, you know, transparency on briefs and where that's going and actually what's, you know, the dialogue between client and agency. And there's, you know, they've been there since I started. They won't go away in my lifetime, most probably. But I think at different points, they get amplified. And that's puns. They're coming. Just going to seed that shit all the way through.
I want to go back because that will help me understand how you've ended up here at Amplify.
Yeah.
A lot of your experience was at Jack Morton. Before we get there, how did you go from being a very good English student with # Getty Images, and how did you move into becoming a CCO? What was your journey into that?
Like everyone, lied, cheated, faked it till I was able to sort of make it. totally unconventional. And I think, you know, there was no course pathway to advertising in its broadest strokes that was visible. I could think it would be the sort of thing I would have loved to have done if I'd seen it. Actually, from English, I went into broadcasting, and that's what I did, and took broadcast journalism at uni, at Leeds, mighty Leeds. and it was amazing because it was done kind of in conjunction with the BBC, and it tapped into law and politics and all this sort of other stuff I was interested in, but you got to write. And actually, you know, it was with the ambition at that point, I think, of probably wanting to be a football commentator. You'd said what I wanted to do at 18 was like football commentary.
Amazing.
Jeb and Motson, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I was all over that stuff and produced a football show when I was in Leeds and stuff of that ilk. But I think what it taught me and still serves me so well today is, you know, cutting to the heart of how we're communicating, being so succinct with it. And can you articulate, you know, an idea or something that's happening very quickly and in a way that can just connect with an audience? And then being able to deliver that, like, I love the hand waving. So how do you tell that story back, both through what you're writing, but then ultimately how you're going to bring that story to life, either in the room or connecting with different audiences?
Did you specialise? So when you went from journalism into communications or advertising and marketing, did you quickly go, which part of this do I like? I imagine
absolutely
that wasn't
absolutely not.
Case. Yeah.
No. Absolutely not.
What happened?
So what happened was uni finished. And I decided I sort of wanted to pivot away from journalism in its kind of pure entity, and instead wanted to look at film and was interested in where film production was going and filmmaking, which was obviously one facet of the course, which I really, really enjoyed. So did that classic thing, moved to London, didn't know anyone, didn't have any family down here or connections to speak of whatsoever. My best mate's gran was at sweetheart, and she put me up on, you know, a spare room floor type stuff and let me come down and live there for rent free and go chase the dream. And I was kind of working every hour God sends and, you know, temping and just trying to earn money and whatever else and get onto film sets and just try and build connections. And at the time, my girlfriend, who's now my wife, came down and she got this job at this agency called Jack Morton, and she was in their marketing department. And I was doing temping work in kind of education, and the summer came round and it obviously all dried up with the summer holidays, and she was just like, oh, there's this assessment day coming in, I think you might like it, like, there's quite a lot of overlap with what you're doing with film and everything you're putting together at the minute. And it coincided with me getting properly like first paid role in film, and I was like, oh, this is a crossroads moment, what do I do? And I looked at Jack's work and it was like the Olympics and the fireworks and everything else, and I was like, this is really interesting, it's kind of just doing storytelling in a different way. So I just threw my hat in the ring to go to this assessment day, which I don't even know if they do it anymore, but in those days it was like this, like 9 hour, you name it, like present for 5 minutes solo, here's a fiver, go and buy stuff and tell us what it means. Like, it was actually quite good fun. I relish that sort of stuff. Some people hate that, I love it.
Lord Sugar's there.
Right. Yeah, it kind of was ahead of its time. But I just threw my hat in the ring for that and left and thought, yeah, that went really well and I really enjoyed that and this could be great. And, you know, I got home and had a chat the next day and I didn't get the job. I was like, oh, crap, never mind. But then they gave me a call and they were like, you didn't get the job because we want you to work here, but we don't really know what you are, which all credit to them. They brought me in a nondescript context. They were like, we think you should be here, but we don't know as what, so just come back. So I did. And I was there for 10 years and that's how it began. But again, it wasn't even a traditional journey then because I started in production. Because that was the gateway through. And I think also I think it's changed a lot now, but certainly, you know, if Alex were here, if he'd bother you up, he's ECD at Amplify, same thing. There wasn't a creative doorway through, because at that time, if you hadn't been to art school or, you know, if you hadn't been through a traditional creative channel, then I think a lot of it, and this isn't a criticism of Jack at all, this is industry-wide, I just don't think there was that recognition of how your creativity could shine and develop and really be acknowledged. So I went in through production and I wouldn't change it for a minute, because it actually gave me such an amazing grounding, understanding not only of how we connect into the different facets of making and what we do, but just the versatility. You know, that's, again, like the journalism side of things, that informs still what I'm doing today in terms of where an idea comes from. The more so the shape I think it takes in terms of how that can be realised, which isn't dream killing. It's actually just understanding the parameters within which creativity can be expressed, I think. And so it's a great footing. So I started there, and then again, I didn't make a lot of sense. So there was me and a couple of other people who, and again, credit to Jack, they made up a department overnight called experience design, which had no real meaning other than we've got three people in the wrong place and we don't know what to do with them. But three of us stepped over to this department and we started to do well and we won work and, you know, I think we were putting out some of the best work the agency was doing. So that then morphed into a channel into creative and a pathway to creative director.
And did they have a creative department or was that a thing that kind of... Before, I would always have Jack Morton down as experiential agency 101, right? These are the guys that did, I mean, Olympics, big events. Yeah. Experiential events. And I wouldn't have put them down for really anything other than, not that that's a small thing, but it's definitely not the whole integrated piece of the puzzle. Did that ever change or would they remain like that for the whole time?
Big time. Yeah, it's a huge evolution, I think. And one of the credits to Jack, I think they're always at the pinnacle in terms of that ability to be self-aware of where they are and that evolution that needs to happen. So I would say, yes, did they step out of, and I think it was already happening when I joined, you know, and started my career, but from what was probably more of the production agency aspect of those big set pieces that only kind of they and very few others could do, put a marker in the ground and said, we're going to be creative led and that's what we're going to do. And that was a huge shift culturally and talent wise and everything of that ilk, and really put the emphasis on it. Because I would say at that point, they didn't, when I joined, the creative department, not really in its traditional sense. There was something called creative writing and design. Design was always a key part of it, but they kind of sat separately, actually putting ideas at the top and understanding where that connects. They had strategy, they had all the bits in play, but I think it's just the big cultural shift of we're going to be creative led. And that certainly happened during my time and probably was quite lucky in the sense of when that segued in and my own journey and pivoting through. And they've gone on and, you know, now in terms of innovation and they continue to evolve at a rate of knots.
What would you have called them? So in a sentence, I want to know the difference, right?
Yeah.
In a sentence, how would you have described them when you joined them? And in a sentence, how would you describe them when you left?
I would describe them when I joined as like, yeah, world-renowned experiential agency, you know, in terms of the scale of what they were doing. I think they were a creative first brand experience agency when I left.
A creative first brand experience
that's
agency.
Very lofty, isn't it? They would have just talked about themselves as a brand experience agency.
What is that? What's the difference between an experiential agency and a brand experience agency?
I think at that point, you know, it was for agencies who were talking about themselves as experiential, it was the ones that were elevating live events, experiences beyond, hey, here's a production delivery of stuff, which is fine for the people that want to do that stuff. I think where they got to was just a whole new level of sophistication that was about, you know, actually exploring what the brand world was doing at every touch point, not just in the live moment and how that could start to connect through the line. And I mean, you look at their work now, it's spreading into innovation, emerging technologies, content. It's all the different facets of storytelling, really. So I think they were on that journey by the time I left, definitely.
Okay, I want to move into Amplify.
Yeah.
Because, okay, these guys, the story is amazing how it's changed. Right now they're working with, should I do this? Yes. Spotify, Google, Sonos, Facebook, like name a brand you've worked with. Name a brand that you would like to work with. PlayStation, Amplify would have touched it, Pinterest. I can keep on going, right? And all those are in tech, right? We've not even covered things like fashion brands and everything else that you guys cover, which is amazing. Why did you leave Jack Morton, arguably at its kind of height of becoming this brand experience agency, to then move across to Amplify, who I would say would have been a much smaller version of that at the time?
Yeah, it's a bit of a crossroads moment for me, I guess. You know, I'd been to Seoul, I'd opened the office there for a year and come back. And I think more and more, I just felt ready to lead and had kind of been establishing a philosophy. So I ran a team. So our team was like a little microcosm in itself. It was like a little mini agency of sorts. And the work we were putting out, it felt different a lot of the time to a lot of the stuff that I was seeing left and right. And more so, I think there was just this philosophy developing of the best work we were making was invariably because someone in the team didn't make sense. But actually, the further I went and found weirder, wonderful people and brought them in and collaborated with them, we were just making new stuff and it was getting better. And I was a bit fatigued possibly by, you know, at that point, the industry in general, I think a lot of the work felt the same. It looked the same. With the greatest respect to freelance community, you know, most of them could tick the top agencies they've been to. And it just felt like this was ripe for change and there was a different way of doing things. So I think I was just genuinely at that point in my career, I was looking for that opportunity of someone to say, hey, go do this thing, build it. And we had a truly inspirational ECD at Jack, who'd been there for 35 years, I feel bad being complimentary about him. we'd only just slag each other off all the time. It feels weird. But he was amazing. And he was retiring. So it was that crossroads of, is it at Jack or is it elsewhere? And, you know, I would have, being candid, I would have loved to have been there, I thought, at that moment in time. When someone's been there for so long, you can, it's the opportunity to look beyond your own walls, right? And and they brought a fantastic candidate in externally. And that was the impetus I needed to go, cool, it's time to jump. It's time to move.
Yeah.
So actually, what at the time was probably a bitter disappointment in my career, if I'm really honest, turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. And I think that's one of those lovely moments when you get to reflect and actually, because I had to take a leap of faith as well, right? Actually leave, I've been there for 10 years, my wife worked there, it was basically home.
Healing as well, which is, I mean, that might have been quite an easy, but Acton, right? It's in Acton.
It was, yeah, they've moved now, thanks right. guys. Yeah, 10 years I commuted to Acton from East London.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Just staying in Acton for 10
years.
Yeah,
I mean.
That in itself.
But again, do you know what though? That is like testament to them and what they've built.
Yeah.
That like true. Creators would travel from East London to Acton every day because it was special and they built something and it's still amazing.
So what was the pitch? You met with Jonathan Emmons, I imagine, the CEO.
Amplify, it was weird because Amplify, they listed for a creative director.
Right.
That was the job post that I responded to, which obviously wasn't really the job I was looking for, but I'd known of Amplify. I'd always, you know, really liked their work. I think they were finger on the pulse of culture and zeitgeist and had interest in brands, and it was just an agency respected. You're like, they're doing some interesting stuff over there. So I was keen to chat with them when I saw the job come up, and then when I kind of got under the skin of what the opportunity was, it became more appealing. And I've never been someone that's really hung up on titles. It was like the title wasn't the thing, it was the opportunity that was the thing, because at that point Amplify, so where are we now, they would have been 7-ish years old, born out of recession, so already trying to break the mold, do things differently, you know, the rigor of the traditional, but behaving very much in an untraditional way most of the time. But there wasn't a creative department, you know. Jonathan didn't want, I think there was a concern about possibly having an in-house style. And actually, if an agency wants to connect with audiences like through the lens of culture, then let's collaborate with them there. If we're working with Spotify and Grime, let's go collaborate with the Grime creatives. Really interesting point of view and something we still harness, celebrate now. We love, you know, it's not about within the four walls of our place, it's about being able to collaborate beyond. And but when you get to a certain level of success, scale, that becomes pretty unsustainable. And that was my moment to come in and have the remit to build it and to, I think, really put, again, you know, creative first in terms of what we're doing. God, I should always say, it's so easy to sit and go creative. Like, strategy is a huge part of what we do. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's so easy from the marketing position of agency to go, yeah, we're a creative first agency. It's like, well, you're not. You're a you're a strat and creative first agency. That's what you are, because you can't work without them. But yeah, it was an opportunity to build something. And, you know, again, being totally honest, I went home after day two and turned to my wife and said, I've made a huge mistake.
Really?
not because they weren't lovely, because they were, and not because the clients weren't amazing, and it was a great start to things. More just because, like, there is literally no one here. Mm-hmm. I genuinely was like, I don't know how they've been outputting this work. Like, there's two people of a kind of creative skew and flavour, and everything was outsourced, and it was just like, wow, this is going to be challenging. But by the end of day five, I went home and was like, do you know what? This is amazing.
This is amazing.
Because it wasn't like trying to turn an oil tanker in the sea. You're not in, you know, a big network agency that's got, you know, so many things you can move, but actually lots of it you can't. I was sitting in an independent, really entrepreneurial space that didn't have any legacy in terms of, you know, there was no real creative baggage that was coming with it. And I've been really, you know, transparent and candid in the conversations in both directions with Jonathan and the other partners about, if I'm coming in to do this, give me the space to do it. Give me the remit and let me do it my way. Which isn't to be ego-led, it's just to say, you've just got to give it space. Like, you've got to let this thing kind of cultivate and grow. That's where the best creative comes from. And they did. And I really felt after that first week, I was like, I'm going to be given the chance to do this. Let's go. So it was all underpinned with that philosophy. It was like, right, let's go and find the people that don't make sense. Let's stop doing everything else. You know, everything that every other agency, with the greatest respect, is, or as I saw it at that moment, doing. There's got to be a different way to build a team and to think about creativity.
Yeah, and I think that's the way that I know Amplify. I've been working with you for 2 years, I think, and it's always been that element of it, and the agency as it is now. like, what would you say was been the biggest shift from what Amplify were to what people know them as now?
In a lovely way, you know, Ollie touched upon it. Amplify had great clients. Amplify was doing really interesting work. I think probably the biggest shift, we've added a few more, which is lovely. I think we've moved into other spaces and areas, Legos and other lovely brands that we get to work with and collaborate with now. I think it's when you look at the breadth of work and the way we always talk about it and still do, and I love this about us, is we talk about the agency as a portfolio. And I think just getting that mindset of, yes, there are commercials and there's all the important stuff and revenue and, you know, the things of profitable businesses and all that stuff, but actually talk about the portfolio, because that's what a great creative does. That's what I do with my team. Mm. Like, where's your book at? Where do you want your work to be? What do you want to, you know, what are the new experiences you want to tap into? And I think, you know, we're sort of still like kids in a sweet shop in that regard. So we look at it as the portfolio of work. And I think that's allowed us to really explore new areas. Obviously, the big COVID word expedited things, changed things, all bets were off. We had to shift and move quickly. But actually, the shift we made was just expediting the plans we had anyway. So I think it's allowed us to really spread to where we are now. You know, probably when I joined, I'd say we were a brand experience agency, definitely. Where we are and talk about ourselves now is as a creative agency that specializes in experience and culture, because actually the channel's kind of irrelevant for us. It's actually what story we're telling, how do we put narrative design at the heart of it, and where do we best connect with that audience? And I think that's the biggest shift, other than the fact there's now 35 people in creative, and there were two when I joined.
Mad.
What was a big whale moment? So, or I guess like proof that you were no longer just a brand experience agency and had become a creative agency?
We've probably got, along the way, there are probably, you know, as I'd see it, seminal pieces of work, which may not be seminal to the outside world, but certainly in terms of, I think, where we were going creatively, capabilities, how that was starting to come through. Google are amazing, long-standing client. We did two pieces of work with them in 2018 that were the launch of YouTube Music, which we did at 180 The Strand. So it was this lovely space where we were the first brand to go in there, kind of cutting through, but it was a curatorial experience. It was like leaning into the type of exhibition you'd expect to see and how we told those stories. Like, it was brand experience, but it was taking it to a different space, and it behaved like a content engine. So it was designed for the audience to capture and share, and had all manner of, it was a full 360 piece basically wrapped around what still was an experience at its core. I think that was an important moment, because I think it showed the sophistication of where we wanted to move the storytelling through that lens. And then quickly followed up with the Curiosity Rooms, which did at Regent Street, which was just blew up. It was huge, you know. And I think, again, showing the potential of when you connect on, and again, all credit to Google, they brought all the agencies in at the same time to brief everyone simultaneously. So we were connected into, you know, alongside the ATL agency, alongside what that global platform was going to be. And actually, when we talk about making every day more extraordinary, what does that mean? And how can we tap that through a multitude of channels rather than just saying, hey, there's a launch event over there? Mm-hmm. That gave us the opportunity to really push and think creatively. And I think that as a piece of work, you know, I talked to the team about work that passes the pub test. If people are talking about the work unprompted by me at the pub, we've done something right in terms of hopefully contributing or shaping a bit of culture.
You're not just going around pubs in the living
room. Yeah, literally.
Have you seen those curiosity
rooms? Yeah, exactly.
How would you describe curiosity rooms to your mate in a pub that knows nothing about advertising?
It's great. Do you want to come down?
Please,
we need visitors. Now, do you know what? What I loved about it was, of the mates that where it did pass the pub test, people were talking about it in different ways. It was because we had that podcast they loved that was being recorded live in the space. We had a fashion show that took place. There were different contributors who were coming down from different places and neighborhoods they loved, who suddenly were getting a light shone upon them. Like, they were all mad. I think that was the lovely thing. There were so many different ways into it that actually, albeit a brand experience, I think it started to demonstrate both the scale also. I think that was an important shift for Amplify at that time. Like, what's the scale of work? Because actually, when you deliver something like that, that's about as big as it gets in terms of, you can kind of do anything on a global scale. And I think that certainly put us in an interesting space. The other one is probably PS5. Because again, I think out of all of the work that came out of the pandemic, that's another one where all bets were off and we got to break the format on the traditional model. You know, that would have been something that you launch a new console, there's a set formula, right? Because it works. People queue up in the pouring rain for 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. Someone lifts it aloft and celebrates that and generally gets on TV. And somewhere nearby, there's a building bathed in blue light for your PlayStation flavored. And that's how it's done. You couldn't do that. Everyone was in lockdown. So what are you going to do? And I think, again, we're an agency that's always relished those opportunities to say, cool, that's a real challenge. Let us come to you with something new and fresh and creative. So I think PS5 allowed us to do that with the anamorphic pieces and everything we created around it. And then the other one that came out of COVID that, you know, I think is just testament to where we have moved to as a creative agency is Casa de Papel with Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
So that's like, what is that? Well, it's an original entertainment format. It creates IP off an existing global IP. Is it an experience?
Money heist, right?
Yeah, Money Heist, sorry, yeah. So.
And just for people that don't have no idea what that is, because even I was like, Casa de Papel, how would you describe, because that to me looked like crazy culty behavior happening on behalf of a Netflix show. What happened there?
So Money Heist, pre-Squid Game, biggest global hit, final season coming up. How do you re-energize a fan base that have been waiting for this final season? So Netflix wanted to find the biggest fan, which was cool. And I think they wanted to do an online quiz to kind of start things off. And we just felt we could push that further. And actually, when we asked ourselves the question of what would it mean to the biggest fan to win, then it's about becoming part of that universe. And actually, if you don't know the show, all the main characters are like Shanghai, Nairobi, they're all named after cities. Could we bring someone into canon? Could we make them a character officially and be part of that world forever, the world they care deeply about? Mm. So we started to think around that and what would that take? And actually, it's about dropping them into that universe. So could we create a show that was designed to live through socials, but it began as this campaign to find the biggest fan, and lots of people entered, and then we asked them to do tapes to show why they were the biggest fan. They were their casting tapes. And we found six people from across France, and they represented their cities, Lyon, Biarritz, wherever they came from. And we dropped them into this world, and it was the show. It was, you know, I guess part escape room, part reality TV, part cinematic expression of the show. It was like a little love note to it. It wasn't trying to replicate scenes. It was like, you're in this universe, and actually, can we build that world out around you? And in doing so, kind of test your knowledge of the show but create something moreover that's just genuinely entertaining. Whether you love Money Heist or not, it was like, how do we make something that's just going to be entertaining? So we made a 30-minute show that went out, and it just sort of didn't stop there, because our winner, Leon, who, this amazing guy, I think he'd learned Spanish because of the show, and you name it, like, these guys were diehard, but they were brilliant. He won, but then we made him the focus of the out-of-home campaign. So we shot him as Leon, in character, and he became the out-of-home of Paris, which, that's again, cool. Like, to cut through and just talk about a show in a different way, that was just a totally fresh way of thinking. But is that brand experience? Yeah, it is. Six people did it. Is it a TV show? Yeah, it is. You know, is it original IP and entertainment? Yep. Is it about world building? Yep. Like, that's where I think we're going. So, very long-winded way of getting back to your question. I think we started as a brand experience agency. Now for us, it's all about world building. And world building allows us to take you anywhere, through any medium, through any channel. And if I'm really honest, the best work I'm seeing right now, not just from us, but elsewhere, I think it's in the spaces in between channels. I don't think it's about, we operate in this channel, or this is the particular channel mix. It's like, the spaces in between are where we're connecting with audiences in new and interesting ways. And I think that's what we look to try and do, certainly through our work, is like break formats and blur the lines as much as we can.
Yeah, I do think that what Amplify has always done and is still doing really well is actually getting deep into those subcultures, which, like what you just mentioned, would not have been possible if you didn't understand the subculture within that. I think, like, how do you think that you're gonna maintain that, and how do you do it so well of understanding the intricacies of each and every one?
Strat. Audience. You know, for us, everything is audience. It's got to begin there, which I know sounds like such an obvious thing to say, but understanding what they love, want, need, care about is where everything begins. And that can be, you know, we've just done some lovely work with Nike, and we've got some amazing work in the pipeline with Lego, and we get to work with these brands that are so, like, influential in culture. But actually, we love the challenge on the other end as well, about how do we connect with an audience for a shoe brand that isn't selling, or anything in between, really. I think it's, for us, just about making meaningful connections with the audience. Mm-hmm. And if we start there and then hopefully apply some original thinking and creativity, then I hope there's a way for us to kind of, not shape, but maybe contribute to culture. Like, for us, it's about trying to come up with ideas through the lens of culture. And the North Star is always, can we create or shape a bit of it? We're never gonna get there. Like, that's the aspiration, that's the North Star. But I think with that mindset of genuinely put the audience first, what do they want, love, need, care about, and then how do we connect with them through that lens of culture? That's always our starting point.
Yeah.
What do you guys do if you have Honda coming to you and they say,
love that brand,
we want to add or contribute to culture in Japanese worm threading. It's a new knitting thing that they're doing over there. And they're like, you must have heard of it. Anyway, let us know what you come up with. Like, is there a point where the subculture gets to the point where you're like, how are we going to find this thing out? Because surely, unless Amplify becomes a huge business of every single different subculture, it's really hard for you to understand all of them that exist.
Totally, but I think it's also about them. You know, I think one of the things that's really interesting right now is the power of community and where community's going, and actually the shift across the industry and landscape about how less influence are singular and actually more communities. And I think what we're seeing through, you know, the discords of this world is that there's a place for any community. Worm threading, was it? Whatever it is.
Yeah,
like,
Japanese
there's, thank you. There's a place for you in your community and how we tap into that. And, you know, I think often things can become greater than the sum of their parts. You know, we do work with Dr. Martens, and actually they've always been about subcultures. The work and the stuff we've been creating with them has actually been going deeper and finding more niche subcultures. But again, when you stitch all that together, when you show that story as a collective, even if your passions aren't in Japanese worm threading, you can start to get an appreciation of it and also recognize what a brand stands for and the support for those subcultures. So I don't know if there is a niche that's too niche. I think it's more actually how does that feed into the bigger story you're trying to tell, if it is Japanese worm threading. But also, that sounds kind of cool. Like, no one's touched that. I'm like, sweet, Honda, this is ace.
Let's go. Yeah, I think it's like the way that you are able to still marry that narrative and storytelling and actually amplifying the subculture's voices. You're welcome. That is where you really excel, rather than, I think that there's a whole thing of like people using culture as clout and not really understanding it, which is then where it gets like a bad name of work being made. But you're always on the other side of that and probably understanding it so nichely and so much that it then works, which I think is what, as an agency, is why you've always been able to say we're a culture first agency and keep that.
Yeah.
Like when the rest of the noise of every other agency in the world saying, well, we do culture too. It's like, but you do it on the surface. You don't dive into the actual elements of doing it.
Yeah, I think totally. It makes a lot of sense. You know, it's tricky because it's become a sort of like overused word, right?
Yeah.
Certainly, and they're like, oh yeah, God, yeah, everywhere. Which we've like had to reconcile. So we're like, oh, we've been talking about this since we kind of began, and this is like really how we think and, you know, believe in creativity. But we sort of asked ourselves the question about, well, we've just got to stay true to how we do it. It isn't about appropriation and just grabbing and jumping on bandwagon. It is genuinely about connecting with audiences in more meaningful and engaging ways. So if we stay true to that and get deeper into every audience we're trying to connect with, and, you know, let our amazing Stratcoms and culture team do their job brilliantly and then connect that into creative, then hopefully we can still keep bridging that in interesting and new ways. So yeah, it's something we had to reconcile, because you walk into a room with, you know, especially with new clients, you're like, oh yeah, we bring ideas to life through the lens of culture. It's like, uh-huh. But yeah, that's where we began. And I think as long as we stay true to the ways that we look to contribute, then hopefully that remains kind of true.
I want to get your crystal ball out now and kind of move more into the industry if we can. I think Amplify are doing wonderful things. I wanted to ask you, where will Amplify be in 2 years' time, do you think? But I also wanted you to answer that on an industry scale. Where do you think, what's going to change undeniably in the next 2 years, and how will that impact Amplify and the wider industry, do you think?
Aside from world domination, from our point of view, the inevitable. I think the big thing that I'm talking with the team a lot about at the minute, and actually starting to engage with clients as well, is, you know, it's good things that came out of the pandemic, actually, creatively. Some bad, and hangovers, and timings, and various other things I won't drum on about now, but I think we lost sight of craft. I really do. I think the way that we had to move at a pace in all directions, good and bad, really lost sight of craft. And I think craft's more important than ever, because we've got, you know, suddenly emerging technologies coming at a rate of knots, which are really exciting, by the way, like insane new creative tools that we're gonna get to play with. We've got new spaces where communities are starting to harbor, really, really interesting. Actually, we can't lose sight of the craft. And I think for us right now, what we really wanna double down on is that, you know, concept, big idea, they'll always live at the heart of what we do, but how can you bring craft through the lens of design, through content, through innovation, because that's how you're going to bridge into those new communities in new ways. So, if I was saying, you know, the next 2 years, both with an Amplify hat on and more broadly, I think the ones that are going to win are the ones that really commit to craft and where that's going next. And with it, also, you know, you can't be scared of what's coming. You know, I see there's this really interesting dialogue going on right now about AI creative tools. And are they going to do creatives out of a job? Or what are, they're tools. That's what they are. They're really exciting. Like, we've got hackathons we're running this year, which is, you know, going to, the first one's going to explore the next wave of experience and what that means when you start to harness some of these tools, like AI prompt training. You know, I'm going to steal this line. I will admit this is stolen. Like, the next gen creatives are going to be prompt poets. I love that line. It's not mine. I should have just committed to it, shouldn't I?
Yeah,
I should have just committed to it.
Think about AI in the industry, Jeff.
I've got this really in original line. What I think is, like any good creative, I'll just pilfer for that and make it my own. But I love that. You know, actually, an openness. And I think that's when we talk about creative culture and what studios should do. It's an openness, right? So I think the best studios will be open to that change always. That's been true for the last 20 years plus. But actually, embrace it in a way that celebrates craft. I think that's going to be a big focus for us over the next 2 years, because I think we've just, as an industry, lost sight of that.
Yeah.
For understandable reasons, but we need to get it back quick.
What would you do if you were a creative, strategic person, you're 21 years old, you've gone to a production company, thought you're going to get into journalism, and then suddenly someone goes, have you heard about the marketing and advertising industry? Yeah, right. I want to get into it. What do I do as a 21-year-old? What would you focus on building or developing in terms of skills?
I think the obvious place to start are your passions. You know, we know, and there's a couple of wonderful people you've placed with us who, they didn't get hired for their books. Certainly they didn't get hired for their professional books, because with the greatest respect, they were sitting in the wrong place, making the wrong work, sitting on the wrong accounts. They had side hustles. Mm. You know, they built communities through their passion for photography. They developed a sustainable fashion brand, obviously. a myriad of things, but what are you passionate about? Start putting that into play. You know, when I review books of people starting out, especially, it's like, don't worry about the professional work. Mm. If you got paid for something, but it was doing, you know, a banner ad for a taco brand, don't worry about that. What's the interesting stuff you're doing? So I think passion is a good way to find that kind of gateway into it. Obviously, there's loads more going on now in terms of the post-grad landscape, so you can step into industry and get a real fast-track experience of it. By the same token, one of our really, really talented creatives who joined, what I love, they realized they were in a bit of an arms race out of the pandemic in terms of, you know, hires were off and there's this whole wave of grads coming through. And he went on a mission to connect with as many of them as possible and get hold of every book under the sun. I was chatting to him the other week. I think he's got like 150 books of like new grads. And in the best sort of analytical approach, went through everything of like, this is what's amazing, that's that. Had his top 10, da, da, da. Not to carbon copy work, but just to understand what makes a book today. Because it isn't, hey, I've just done 3 years at ad school and here it is. It's actually a myriad of stuff. Like one of the concepts from the creative pair that we hired, like one of their concepts was about making nudes NFTs. Like revenge porn is a big social problem, right? So what if we made them NFTs? Then they'd always be trapped back. Like you can pull away at the threads a little bit, but yeah. You're just like, fuck, like, that's awesome. Yeah. That's like social problem solving. They've seen this thing and they've just had some original thoughts around it. That isn't, hey, I went to ad school and I got the penguin brief and we mulled it over for 6 weeks. Here's the, you know, like, it doesn't have to be that. And I think, and look, I'm speaking very personally in terms of what we look for and how we engage creatives. But for anyone starting out, it's like, find the shit you care about, find the stuff you're passionate about, and then start to think about how you can harness that and lay that down. Try and connect through community, because there are lots of young creatives of all manner of walks of life out there, whether they're solely on TikTok or whether they're coming out of ad school. And actually, how do you start to think about presenting that work? But it doesn't have to be in the traditional sense. If anything, go the other way.
Thank you very much. I'm going to flip this now.
Yeah.
These wonderful human beings that are coming in, they've built these community ideas and bada bada ba. How might Amplify, and be really honest here.
Yeah, yeah.
Because agencies are going to be losing a lot of talent. I haven't introduced this, but I will.
Yeah.
We're starting a thing called Nobody Wants to Work For You. Mm-hmm. It is all about why Adland and creative businesses in general could be losing some of the best creative and strategic thinkers because they've not thought about the workplace and the environment that they're developing for the best ideas and people to thrive.
Yeah.
So if you were being very critical of yourself and of Amplify, why might you lose somebody very good? And what can you do to prevent that?
Stop being worried about preventing it. I don't think we should talk about retention in the industry. I think retention's the full stop at the end. Actually put the focus into the people, develop them. You know, I talk with every creative. we've got a team of 35 permanent creatives of all different flavors now. Are they going to be at Amplify for their entire career? No. Are they going to end up in great things? Yes, I really hope so. Will they look back at Amplify for however long they're with us and hopefully treasure that experience or at least see the benefits of it? Please, that's my ambition. That's why I get up in the morning. So actually, if we put the energy into talking to them about how do you want to develop? Where do you want to go? Where's your book at? What are you doing? Like, the more energy we put into our people, the longer they're going to want to be there anyway. Mm. So I almost, and this isn't to dodge the question, but I think retention as a word is just something we should leave behind as an industry. I think it's about stats. I think it's about numbers, churn, all this. Park it. Don't care. Focus back in the people. What is making them tick as a creative? What type of experiences haven't they had yet? Where, who do they want to work with? What type of work do they want to make? You know, and the personal stuff, get to know the people as well. Mm. Like, what, in terms of the environment, you've got to build a creative culture that can thrive, right? So if that's, you know, whatever, the fluidity of where you do the work, how you do the work, who you connect with, when you do it, all of that stuff, the more grey we can create, and I think that's one of the things I've learned through leadership as well, like the longer I spend in the grey, the better. The more grey I can create for my team that has enough support and guardrails around it so they feel structured and supported, the better, because they're all completely different beasts. But I much prefer to put the energy into them and where they want their development to go, because I believe they'll be with us longer. It's not, you know, it's not something I do with that goal in mind, but I just think put the energy in the right place. And as an industry, let's stop talking about retention.
I wasn't expecting that, and I'm not going to probe any further on that, because I think that's I'm really happy with that answer. We've I think the workshop that we want to create is about that stuff, right? One of the things that's come up quite a lot, the obvious things like D&I, pay, side hustles, how do you support them? And I think AMV have done something recently where they've spoken about how they're supporting all of those things. I think we want to, the purpose of that workshop is to help agencies work out which one of those things do we really want to matter at our agency. Are we the agency that you come to and we support your side hustle? Are we not? Are we the ones that want to, you know, make sure that we're completely diverse, or you're paid better than any other agency? You know, there'll be loads of different things I think agencies should take on. And you're right, when that moment becomes not right for you as the creative or person within the business, move on. It's not the right place for you anymore. Yeah. Moles, I feel like I've asked a lot of questions. I wanted to make sure I hand it over to you. Sorry.
Thanks. No, I was just going to say that I think in to do with the workshop side of things, it's when agencies try to take hold of every single aspect and do it at a 2 out of 10 rather than double downing on one or two and doing them at an 8 or a 9. And I think how have you found that actually focusing on your creatives and who they are and what they want to do has benefited Amplify on a whole, but the work that they're producing?
I think, you know, the big thing for me, and we're lucky now because we have a certain size where, you know, we get to go and look for particular types of talent, I'd say, in terms of rather than people who can necessarily do everything. So I think really for me it's about trying to identify and connect with creatives who are going to contribute something different. But actually in doing that, I get the opportunity, whether they're very new in the industry or a different juncture, to celebrate that superpower. And I think what we talk about a lot is, you know, really doubling down around where their superpowers sit. Bring that into a studio where actually no one else has got your superpower. So you can own this space, but you're going to get to collaborate with that architect, that sculptor, that coder, that motion designer, and you're going to get a lot more out of this. So I think it's this combination of like hopefully trying to create a collective that nourish each other and they grow together, but also recognizing superpowers and they're okay, and bring them in and celebrate them.
Jevon, I wanted to ask you a question, much more around values actually. Which three values would you look for in a creative person?
I think, you know, I'd begin with being collaborative. I think the environment we want to foster is genuinely collaborative. I think the best creative ones are, but they've got to have that about them, which in that sense means don't come with an ego. I think that's really important for what we want to do, that spirit of where great collaboration genuinely comes from. I think they've got to have drive, because I think we get up every morning and we want to hopefully discover newness and make something amazing. Mm. And I think you've got to be energized by that and have the drive. You know, I'll be brutally honest, our studio moves at an absolute rate of knots. It doesn't wait for anyone, which can be daunting, but I hope it's energizing. And I think with the right characters and the right values, it is. And hopefully our team feel that way. So I'd say collaboration, I'd say drive and passion. Like, that passion needs to bleed into you know, the original thinking that we hope they're going to bring to the table, but also just the stuff they care about. And we're idiots if we don't see those passions and try and tap into them as well, and celebrate them, because they'll only make us better.
Have you ever lost anyone that you wish you didn't lose at Amplify?
Yeah, definitely.
What accountability would you take and what would you do differently?
None. I think we have, but, and this isn't me like trying to swerve the question, I think it was about a life choice. I think it was about a moment in life as well. And I think that's, you know, that's the other thing we have to recognize. You know, life isn't this one big linear line. There's actually phases and windows and points of time. And actually, do you know what, for the individual in question, a lifestyle change is the right thing. They're not going elsewhere. They're going, stepping up to 3 on 12. Even if they were going elsewhere, do you know what, that's the change they want for them, for their development and where they're going next. So it's not to say I can't take any accountability for it, but actually, again, rather than look inwardly, like how could I have kept them? Outwardly, is it the right moment for them? Where are they at? Is that the right step? And as you know, as much as it was like, damn, we've lost a really great, talented individual there, it was right for them. Yeah. So I didn't even try to make them stay. Like, I didn't. There was no. It wasn't that we didn't care. It was just like there's no counter. There's no. Oh no, but what you're gonna miss out? There's none of that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's actually rare, and I can't recall that I've done that with anyone, because to this point, touch wood, it's been the right step for them. So what am I going to do? Support that, obviously.
Does it ever get to the point where they're misunderstood and you have to go, wait, you're missing out on what we're doing here, or maybe you're not clear on what we're trying to achieve. Let me just do some sprinkling of that education and then they stay. Do those moments happen?
We haven't encountered them yet. Could they? I guess yes, definitely. You know, we're constantly evolving and I think there's new opportunities emerging in terms of where the work's going. So, you know, we might hire someone that has a very different skill set to everyone else in the building. And there's a journey to that, right? Both, I think, culturally, internally, about how people harness that individual and those set of skills, and also to clients in terms of how we bake that into the work and weave that in. And we've definitely had those moments, you know, from broadly speaking, you know, what content and that aspect of storytelling represents to us in the body of the work. You know, that's a cultural shift for the agency. We didn't have that as a set function. So bringing that in, that takes time internally and it takes time for clients to latch on about how that informs the work. So for individuals in those moments that are coming in with that skill set, there might be a bit of, you know, creaking and actually biding time for us to really put both process internally, but also ingraining them in the work meaningfully. So I'd say we've definitely had those moments, but certainly not at a point where someone's wanted to leave and we've had to kind of convince them that just better stay with us.
Fine. Jevon, we're going to move into the stinky fish part of this.
This is the trickiest bit.
This is a hard bit.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping you prepared, you know, like Molly and I are prepared today and obviously we rehearsed our lines.
Yeah.
People have said many things about a stinky fish.
Yeah.
I won't reference them on this podcast in case that will just change your thoughts. So have you prepared an answer for your stinky fish?
I have.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if it's going to be a bit crap because I was on the tube on the way here and I was like, what am I going to talk about? It's a stinky fish. I came very close to backpacks on the tube. It was very like on my journey here.
Wait, just you got like, a backpack?
Yeah, no, but I don't wear it. People wearing backpacks.
Oh no, I'm that guy.
It makes me so angry.
You see, I think I could tap in. I think I've got an immediate stinky fish. I was going to talk about Vegemite being secondary to Marmite. Let's go backpack. Backpacks are my stinky fish. And I don't know if it's a London thing. I don't know if it's a city thing. Backpacks are great. You can carry stuff really efficiently. However, if you're on the tube, please take the damn thing off. So I'm going to say backpacks for the fact that people don't know how to wear them is my stinky fish.
I think it's just people don't have any spatial awareness or any understanding that your backpack is taking up the space that a human being could have on this tube, or it's also so close to my face that I've forgotten that I exist in a world outside of your backpack.
And they have no sensory like nerves on them either, so
no.
Like, they won't really know if they're hitting you with this backpack.
No,
particularly if it brushes you.
It's just the worst.
The 360
ever.
Turn on a tube as well. That backpack can go anywhere, my friends. So
just put it on the floor between your feet.
Okay.
And save the space and the face of the person behind you. I think for me, it's probably worse because I'm shorter than you guys.
You're getting
like
bottom of backpack, and
it's
which
just
is dirty,
it's just yeah. full backpack in the face.
Thanks, Jevon.
See, I came. I was like, I'm just going to try this one out. It was like light-minded individual backpacks. Here we go. Latch on.
I'm really passionate.
The other highbrow one I had not needed.
No. Yeah, you could have gone anywhere there. Yeah, but that was a real niche subculture. Well, I want to say thank you. This has been incredible getting to know you even more than we've known you at some early hours of the morning in both Shoreditch and the south of France.